Israeli settlers performed religious rituals at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds, in a move that was banned decades ago. No casualties as rockets target an area near the highly sensitive green zone in Baghdad. No information on who is behind the attack yet. G20 leaders so far failing to endorse a collective commitment on climate change just ahead of a key conference in Glasgow. Top story this hour, the situation has been tense in the occupied Al-Quds in the past few hours after a group of Israeli settlers escorted by armed soldiers entered the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Local sources are telling us that dozens of settlers have performed Jewish rituals at that mosque. Our correspondent Ramallah Mona Kendall explains why the Palestinians see these visits as provocative and if the Israelis are allowed to conduct prayers inside the mosque, silently or otherwise.
What happened this morning is that dozens of Israeli settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, protected by Israeli police officers. They toured the area there, and then, according to local sources, they performed their Jewish rituals there. It's forbidden for Israeli settlers to perform any of their prayers or any kind of prayers, even the so-called silent prayers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, and this has angered the Palestinians. Last month, there was a ruling by an Israeli court that allows the Israeli settlers to perform their silent prayers. However, after rejection and condemnation, anger reactions from the Islamic world, the Palestinians, and Jordan mainly, the Israelis said that they retreated back this decision. However, Palestinians are saying that settlers continue to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex almost on a daily basis, and some of them do not respect the agreements that these are only visits, not for the prayers.
Now, hours ago, a rocket attack targeted a neighborhood near the Green Zone in Baghdad, and that's an important area because most government buildings, as well as foreign missions to Iraq, including the U.S. Embassy, are located there. Security sources saying that three Katyusha rockets fell in the Mansour district in the early morning hours. No reports of deaths or injuries, no claim of responsibility either. And this is the first time since July 29th when a similar attack hit that area. No casualties were reported in that attack either. Only one day after Washington imposed fresh sanctions against Iran, the U.S. and the European signatories to the nuclear deal, sending yet another confusing signal. They're urging Iran to return to the talks soon to avoid what they call a dangerous escalation. In a joint statement following the G20 summit, the quartet is calling on Iran to, quote, change course. And that's a reference to Iran's remedial moves on its nuclear commitments. Tehran stood by its obligations for a whole year and then started cutting back on them in response to the U.S. abandonment of the deal in 2018 and the failure of the European parties to keep their side of the agreement. Iran says it is ready to restart negotiations in late November, but it wants to see the sanctions removed as an outcome of the talks. Washington, though, targeted Tehran's drone program with a new set of sanctions just 2 days ago, a move which Iran says is at odds with the White House claims of wishing to rejoin the agreement. Now, we've talked to academic and geopolitical policy advisor Alexander Azadegan, and he believes that the U.S. and its European allies are doing all they can to remove any incentive for Iran to get back to the negotiating table.
In every negotiation, you need to have good faith. And the Europeans and the party of war in Washington are doing everything to for the Iranians not to have any incentive to come back to the negotiation table. A few days ago, you and I, or you and me and Danny had an interview about Washington using the information they're getting from terrorist groups to use against Iran in terms of human rights violations. This happened a few days before what we are going into with the nuclear negotiations. They keep changing the goalposts. First, it was the French who wanted to dismantle the Iranian missile program, which is the only way the Iranians can protect themselves. Their outdated F-4, F-5, and F-14 jets are not going to protect them. So that was the goal. The Iranians are never going to negotiate over that. That falls under IRGC. And now they're talking about the drone program. Every advancement that Iran has made, they want to change. Basically, the goal is regime change. And what they did to Libya, just basically destroy the country from within, have different gangs running the country, the balkanization of not just the Middle East, but Iran in particular. That's what these people have in mind. And JCPOA was simply an excuse to bring the Iranians to the so-called negotiation table and just negotiate continuously. It's laughable. No country in the world would negotiate this way.
All right, moving on, the Iranian deputy foreign minister is saying that no country has the right to talk about Iran's defense capabilities. Ali Balgharikani has rejected the U.S. attempts to link the Vienna talks with Iran's defense program. It says that every country has the right to build a strong deterrent and that Iran is also entitled to develop its own defense capabilities. He noted that Iran's defense power is aimed at ensuring national interests and security. Balgharikani made those comments in an interview with Russia Today in response to the host's question about certain attempts to link the talks on the 2015 nuclear deal to Iran's missile program. He said that progress in the Vienna talks depends on a strong will to accept the removal of cruel and illegal sanctions imposed on Iran. Political analyst David Yakubian says that U.S. President Biden's administration refuses to show goodwill regarding the revival of the JCPOA.
Well, unfortunately, one of the last remaining tools in the imperial tool bag of the United States is sanctions. And the United States is clearly just addicted to sanctions. Its efforts at occupation, regime change, color revolution, those continued by the Biden administration that were either initiated or perpetuated by the Trump administration. And so this is really all the Biden administration has. And unfortunately, it is refusing to show goodwill on the eve of potential re-engagement in Vienna regarding the JCPOA by issuing yet another round of sanctions, this time against four individuals and two entities related to Iran's UAV program. I agree with Ali Balgharikani regarding the necessity for nations to respect other nations and their conventional defensive capabilities, but I do have to say that some nations, based on their historical track record and their lack of aggression, I think have very good reason to be concerned about the military developments in neighboring nations. And just briefly, Iran having not attacked a foreign country in almost 300 years.
Iran's civil defense chief says that Israel and the U.S. are likely behind a cyber attack that disrupted gasoline sales across the Islamic Republic. Ghulam Reza Jalali made that announcement in an interview with the national broadcaster. He said that analytically, it's believed that the attack was performed by the Israeli regime, the Americans, and their agents. He, however, said that a technical investigation into the matter has yet to be completed. On Tuesday, cyber attack caused nationwide disruptions to the smart card system used to buy subsidized fuel at pumps. Around half of Iran's 4,300 gas stations have been reconnected and resumed the sale of subsidized fuel. Taliban officials say that they are fulfilling their promises that they have made after taking over Afghanistan in mid-August, but some African people seem to have a different opinion, a correspondent reports.
In response to international calls for forming an inclusive government in Afghanistan, the Taliban said that the current cabinet is interim and efforts are underway to make it all-inclusive. Deputy spokesman of the Taliban, Bilal Karimi, said that they are fulfilling their promises and urged countries to cooperate with them and let the new government prove itself.
Yes.
The current cabinet is not finalized. It may have weaknesses, but we are completing and improving it. There are representatives from all Afghans, but it still needs to be more inclusive. We are committed to human and women rights in Afghanistan. Works are underway to provide a safe ground for education and employment of girls and women.
Experts and Afghans believe that the formation of an inclusive government is a popular demand. Many believe that the Taliban have so far failed to fulfill their promises.
In my opinion, the Taliban have not fulfilled even 10% of the promises they made to us. However, the security is somehow better, but what about women's rights and social justice? 90% of the officials in the high levels of government are the Taliban themselves.
The Taliban made many good promises to the people, but did not keep them. They said that they would create jobs and protect women's rights, but now joblessness is rising and women are locked at homes.
On Wednesday, foreign ministers of Afghanistan's neighboring countries gathered in Iranian capital with the aim of emphasizing the call for the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan. Addressing the conference, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the timing of officially recognizing the new governance in Afghanistan depends on how fast an inclusive government is formed in the country.
The Taliban took power more than 2 months ago. However, new country has yet recognized the rule over Afghanistan. This is why aid to the country have been halted and its assets remain frozen amid an unfolding humanitarian crisis in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Now, the controversy over how the COVID came into being still dragging on. Beijing now asking Washington to stop smearing it and saying that a U.S. intelligence review into the origins of COVID-19 is not only political, but also false. China's foreign minister is calling for a scientific and responsible approach in any such research. The U.S. has just released a more detailed version of its intelligence review into the origins of the pandemic. The report accuses China of not collaborating and hindering a global investigation into the issue. It says in the absence of more information, it's hard to conclude whether the virus emerged via animal-to-human transmission or leaked from a laboratory. Wang, however, believes it's all nothing but political hype. He made those comments on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Rome. Well, all eyes on Rome, where G20 leaders are getting together to discuss major international concerns. Top among them, the issue of climate. So far, no tangible success. Now, the summit is held in the lead up to another major gathering of world leaders in Glasgow for a UN event on climate change. In just a few hours, delegates from around 200 countries will be attending that summit in Scotland called COP26. The event was delayed by a year because of the COVID pandemic. During a two-week conference, the countries will introduce their plans to cut emissions by 2030. The UN Meteorology Body is warning in a new report that the world countries' existing pledges to cut emissions would see the planet's average temperature rise 2.7 degrees Celsius this century. Meantime, leaders from G20 countries are discussing climate in Rome, trying to bridge their differences on how to combat global warming. We'll continue to bring you the latest developments from that event. Now, in France, the Yellow Vests protested in urban centers and rural roundabouts for the third consecutive week, and this is indicating to many that they're back to being a weekly fixture of the French political scene. From Paris, Robin Mazahari has more.
While France's weekly protests against the corona vaccine pass have become greatly diminished, probably because Parliament appears certain to approve using the so-called health pass until after next spring's elections, the Yellow Vests continue to turn out in significant numbers nationwide. For several months, the two groups have often been conflated by the mainstream media, but the anti-vaccine pass protests are organized by a leading far-right politician, while the Yellow Vests disavow links to any political party, but especially the far right. The Yellow Vests often march in several different groups in Paris, but they share essentially the same reasons for protesting.
We will be marching every Saturday to demand our human rights and our human dignity. We are here because there is no economic justice in France. France is an oligarchy composed of political elite, union leaders, and high finance. They suck the life and riches out of the real producers of our nation's wealth, the workers.
The Yellow Vests began 3 years ago in response to record high gas prices. Around Europe, energy prices have just exploded to new records. However, there is even more economic difficulty and instability now than when the Yellow Vests first took to the streets.
Inflation is at its highest point since 2008. Back then, unemployment was 30% lower than it is today. Economic growth is widely expected to slow dramatically from this quarter onwards. The era of austerity has left France economically unprepared for the coronavirus era, and many believe that social unrest could return to the shocking levels of 2019.
En Tunisie, etc.
I think what you're seeing is similar to the revolutions which began in Tunisia and swept the Arab world. The abuse of human liberty by our government is provoking the same type of conditions in France. They say that there is no more yellow vests. It's not true. We are right here and living on our feet instead of dying on our knees.
French media coverage of the yellow vests diminished to almost nothing in May of 2019. Just 3 weeks into season two, seemingly no domestic media witnessed the demonstrations in Paris. Contrarily, there continues to be an overwhelming police presence of seemingly one heavily armed riot cop for every two protesters, increasing the chances for provocation and violence against unarmed protesters. Armin Mazaheri, Paris.
Let's now take a look at Japan. Polls have opened in general election where Prime Minister Fumio Kishida's party is fighting to save its majority in the lower house. Now, across Japan, just over 1,050 candidates are vying for the House of Representatives' 465 seats. The Prime Minister is hoping to win over a pandemic-fatigued public with spending promises. This after Kishida called the election amid public frustration over his party's handling of the coronavirus pandemic and worsening economic inequality. Kishida became leader of the Liberal Democratic Party a month ago after his predecessor resigned amid public discontent over his response to the COVID crisis. And that brings it to the end of this news broadcast.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we looked at how the ongoing epidemic of men's violence in America is rooted in this inability as a society to move beyond outmoded ideals of manhood. In a sweeping analysis that cut across racial, ethnic, and class lines, we examined mass shootings, day-to-day gun violence, violence against women, bullying, and American militarism against the backdrop of a culture that has normalized violent and regressive forms of masculinity in the face of challenges to traditional male power and authority. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
It turns out that Lord Baden-Powell bonded the Boy Scout for a very explicit reason, to counteract what he perceived as a decline in the manly virtues. In his influential book, Rovering to Success, A Guide to Young Manhood, Powell was quite explicit about this. God made men to be men, he wrote. Civilization, with its town life, buses, hot and cold water laid on, everything done for you, tends to make men soft and feckless beings. We badly need training for our lads if we are to keep up manliness in our race instead of lapsing into a nation of soft, sloppy cigarette suckers.
The Scout program is designed to help our sons, cousins, and younger brothers develop the initiative, the resourcefulness, the character, the quick thinking, and the leadership they really need in the somewhat jittery, insecure world in which we live.
Again and again at key moments in American history, you see men reacting to change in just this way by retreating into a hyper-masculine fantasy world. You see it in the rise of popular men's magazines in the 1940s, filled with stories about breathtaking manly adventures in sports. These magazines may look retro to us today, but what's important to remember is that they were just as retro in their own time. As the lives of men grew more sedentary during the consumer boom of the post-war years, as women moved into the workplace in unprecedented numbers and the women's movement gained traction, these magazines offered men a way to hit back at what Ralph Day, the editorial director of True Magazine, describes as the perils of creeping equality. Men were turning to his magazine in unprecedented numbers, Day explained to a group of men in a speech, because it stimulates his masculine ego at a time when man wants to fight back against women's efforts to usurp his traditional role as head of the family. And this backlash has only accelerated exponentially since the 1960s, when the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the anti-war movement rose up to challenge traditional masculine authority like never before, especially the authority of straight white men.
The plain truth of the matter is this has to stop, and it has to stop like the day before yesterday.
Feminism was established so that unattractive, ugly broads could have easy access to the mainstream, right? Did you see it? Yes!
Look at our political culture, where the game is all about establishing your manly credentials by butching yourself up and methodically feminizing and taking apart the manhood of your opponents.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
There was no clearer depiction of this backlash phenomenon than the film Fight Club. The movie portrayed the emasculation of young men by the consumer culture.
We're still men.
Yes, we're men. Men is what we are.
And offered up bare-knuckled violence as a way for men to reclaim their manhood. Regardless of whether we see film as a glamorization or a satire of backlash masculinity, backyard fight clubs have proliferated in the years since the film's release. And at the base of all of this is the belief that the best way for men to restore their dwindling manhood and restore order is through what the cultural historian Richard Slotkin has called the frontier myth of regenerative violence.
Most people understand that guns make you safer, especially because society is degenerating. There's going to be a lot of craziness going on, and so we need guns to protect ourselves.
To older working and middle-class white men, the message is clear.
That's the thing that gets me. If I lived on the border and some brown man came running through my backyard that looks like he didn't belong there, so why aren't people doing that?
The basic idea is that the best way to regain power and control is through a barrel of a gun, or as many guns as possible.
They're accurate.
Mm-hmm.
They are dependable.
Yes, they are. Super dependable.
They are extremely well made. You can carry plenty of them on your person at all times.
This white male paranoia and siege mentality have fueled the increasingly aggressive effort to block even the most sensible gun policies.
When the system is overwhelmed, and I mean the system on the entire planet, somebody had better be prepared to protect themselves, their families, their neighborhoods, and the freedom of all mankind. Never let them take your Second Amendment right, ever.
This siege mentality has also fueled the rise of hate groups and militias over the past quarter century.
They're not branches of Al-Qaeda. They're right-wing extremists with lots of guns and an axe to grind against the U.S. government.
Listen, people. Things are bad. Things are real bad. And it's going to get a lot worse. So basically, if people need to wake up, start buying some of these, see?
Groups like these are often described as white supremacist hate groups, which they usually are. But they can also be seen as a kind of reactionary men's movement, an organized expression of white male anxiety and aggrieved entitlement that relies on violence as the preferred means of attaining its goals.
Recovery crews are still searching the waters around an island where a gunman opened fire on young people attending a summer camp.
In recent years, perhaps the most disgusting and morally bankrupt expression of this kind of threatened entitlement was the massacre of 77 people, including 69 teenagers, perpetrated by the Norwegian right-wing fanatic Anders Breivik, a former customer service representative who had been declared unfit for service in the Norwegian army. In his 1,500-page manifesto explaining his reasons for the attack, Breivik ranted against culturalism, but he reserved special venom for feminism's role in emasculating Western men. According to Breivik, feminist ideology and political correctness have been responsible for transforming a patriarchy into a matriarchy and intend to deny the intrinsic worth of males. And by now, men have been reduced to an emasculated, touchy-feely subspecies. What this shows is that a whole lot of men out there fear they're losing control and are turning to violence to reclaim their manhood. In his fascinating study of violence, the psychiatrist James Gilligan interviewed hundreds of violent criminals in American prisons and found that the single most powerful reason they turned to violence was because they felt shamed, humiliated, or disrespected as men. The more time I spent with him, Gilligan writes about one of the hundreds of violent criminals he has interviewed over the course of his research, the clearer it became that his character served as a defense against the threat of being treated with scorn and disrespect, of being perceived as a weakling, not a real man, someone who could be laughed at. We may not hear about it much in mainstream coverage of violence, but again and again we've seen exactly this dynamic. Young men using violence to overcome the shame of not being seen and respected as real men.
16-year-old Luke Woodham entered the Commons area of Pearl High and fired off several shots.
Woodham opened fire at Pearl High School, killing two students.
Consider Luke Woodham, who carried out a school shooting in Pearl, Mississippi in the late 1990s. Woodham wrote a letter before he went on his rampage explaining himself this way. I am not insane, I am angry. I killed because people like me are mistreated every day. All throughout my life, I was ridiculed, always beaten, always hated. If I can't do it through pacifism, if I can't show you through the displaying of intelligence, then I will do it with a bullet. Murder is not weak and slow-witted. Murder is gutsy and daring.
Just minutes after firing two fatal shots at the Virginia Tech dormitory on Monday, Cho Sung-hui returned to his own dorm room and made the final preparations to mail what appears to be a video confession.
Or consider Sung-hee Cho, who committed one of the worst mass shootings in American history when he went on a shooting spree at Virginia Tech University in 2007, killing 32 people. Cho was a socially isolated, troubled young man with a history of mental health problems who had clearly bought into a cultural narrative that says the way to reclaim manhood is through projecting an image of menace and toughness, instilling fear in others, and using violence. Before he committed the Virginia Tech massacre, he wrote, produced, and starred in his own video, demonstrating how thoroughly he'd bought into this Hollywood script. Cho isn't the only mass murderer whose violent actions enabled him to rewrite the script of his life in order to place himself back in the manly starring role.
All you hear is like firecrackers, and then I looked out the window, and there's a kid with a trench coat and a shotgun throwing pipe bombs in the parking lot.
The Columbine killers, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, left behind written diaries that provide insight into how their murder of 12 classmates and a teacher was part of a conscious strategy to settle scores. In his journal, Klebold writes that he and Harris will take revenge on society. And toward the end of his own journal, Harris writes, everyone is always making fun of me because of how I look, how f***ing weak I am, and well, I will get you all back. I hate people, and they better f***ing fear me if they know what's good for them.
The shooter was 36-year-old Andrew Engeldinger, an employee of the small company who had recently lost his job.
And this isn't just about young men. Again and again, we've seen the same thing with older men who commit mass shootings.
A troubled ex-husband is under arrest in the Southern California hair salon shooting that left eight people dead.
In case after case, these men have faced grief, bitter disappointment, and feelings of failure.
The shooter, Richard Farley, was obsessed with a female colleague. He had also been laid off.
They are either chronically unemployed, have been left by their wives or girlfriends, been fired from their jobs, or have suffered some other kind of serious blow to their self-worth as men. Nothing can excuse the pathetic and cowardly way men like these use violence and destroy the lives of innocent people to make some kind of a statement. But we're kidding ourselves if we think these killings will stop unless and until we can identify and transform the larger cultural belief systems that underlie them.
From the mass shooting in Tucson aimed at former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords to the Colorado movie theater massacre, killers in many recent mass killings suffered mental illness.
Of course, there's no question that mental illness has played a role in a lot of rampage killings and mass shootings. But what never seems to get discussed is why it is that somewhere around 98% of school shootings and rampage killings have been committed by men, even though there are plenty of young women who suffer from mental illness as well. What this tells us is that violence can't be reduced to mental illness on its own, especially since the vast majority of mentally ill people are not violent at all. The bottom line is that even men who are mentally ill live and operate within a culture that has normalized violent masculinity and defined manhood in exceedingly narrow ways.
It's been widely reported school shooter Adam Lanza suffered some kind of personality disorder.
The Sandy Hook Elementary school shooter Adam Lanza may have been mentally ill, but he played out a familiar script.
He was bullied severely, brutally bullied, when he was in elementary school at Sandy Hook.
By all accounts, he was a socially awkward boy who didn't fit in and appears to have been mercilessly bullied.
That's a clip of the video game Call of Duty. It's also the game that Adam Lanza used to play.
He developed a revenge fantasy, secured firearms, and then killed his own mother before carrying out one of the most brutal and ruthless mass killings in American history. And in his own delusional and twisted way, he would recapture the sense of respect that seemed to have eluded him his whole life. The children of Newtown, like so many other innocent victims of men's violence, became theatrical props in the performance of an aggrieved, angry, and likely self-hating young man who absorbed all the wrong lessons about what it means to be a tough, strong man from the world around him. Just take a look at the ad campaign the Bushmaster Firearms Company ran prior to the Newtown massacre for the very AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle Lanza used during his killing spree. What all of this amounts to is that our violence problem seems to be a lot less about lone wolves and monsters who fail to conform to society's norms than it is about too many men, in a sense, over-conforming to our norms and ideals of manhood out of fear of not being seen as men. When we talk about men's violence and dominant ideals of violent masculinity, there's a temptation to frame things in terms of the damage men do to others. But we need to look also at the devastating harm these norms do to men themselves. This is certainly true of gun violence. Every year in this country, over 30,000 people are killed by guns, something like 85 per day. The vast majority of these victims are men, approximately 86%. But while we're used to thinking about gun violence in terms of mass shootings and urban crime, we really don't talk a lot about how most gun deaths are the result of men and boys shooting themselves. Suicide, which is really violence turned inward, accounts for close to two-thirds of all gun deaths. The vast majority of people who kill themselves with a gun are men, and white men comprise over 80% of these firearm suicides. Violence doesn't just leave physical scars. It also leaves emotional scars. Look at the cost to African-American boys and young men of living in and around violence. Violence is the leading cause of death of African-American men between the ages of 15 and 30. But they also have much higher than average rates of depression, school dropout, mental health problems linked to perpetual stress, substance abuse. And just look at the terrible toll violence has taken on the psyches of men who serve in combat zones.
In the 5 years between 2006 and 2009, more than 1,100 members of the armed services took their own lives.
Something like half of U.S. service members who have done tours in Iraq and Afghanistan have signs of trauma, depression, flashbacks, alcohol and drug problems. In her landmark study, Trauma and Recovery, Judith Herman draws a powerful connection between the experience of male combat veterans and women who are the victims of domestic and sexual violence. The sources of the violence and their context might vary, but the unifying theme is that human beings, young and old, women and men, suffer when their physical and sexual boundaries are violated. But in the case of men, this pain gets compounded by a cultural belief system that equates manhood with invulnerability and ridicules and shames men who admit to being in emotional pain. In his classic work, I Don't Want to Talk About It, the therapist Terry Real identifies the widespread phenomenon of what he calls covert depression, a condition that roughly three-quarters of American men suffer in silence out of fear of seeming like less than a real man. For many of these men, childhood trauma and other experiences of violence play a role in this depression, which then can affect not only their ability to take care of themselves physically and emotionally, but also hinder their ability to sustain healthy relationships in adult life. Despite predictable arguments that equate trying to understand or prevent violence with weakness, the bottom line is that we have to have the strength to ask these kind of questions if we want to move beyond the never-ending cycle of violence. And that starts with examining the dominant stories we tell ourselves as a culture about manhood and violence, and demanding more honest and accurate representations of the personal and societal consequences of violent masculinity. War movies like Saving Private Ryan showed not only the awe-inspiring courage of the men who stormed the beaches in Normandy and fought totalitarianism during World War II. The film also captured the panic, anxiety, and sheer terror of the young men who experienced that war.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it.
I do.
I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
More recently, The Hurt Locker explored another devastating effect of battlefield trauma. Showing how the intensity and violence of war make it difficult for many veterans to adjust back to civilian life. And we saw the same kind of honest and tragic portrayal of dominant masculinity in the film The Wrestler, starring Mickey Rourke as an over-the-hill professional wrestler whose body was ravaged by physical injury and who was so emotionally damaged by violence that he couldn't imagine life outside the glamour of the arena. Intensely realistic shows like HBO's The Wire have refused to glamorize urban street life and violent crime, directly confronting the costs young men of color too often pay for their investment in the idea that respect comes only at the business end of a Glock. And we've seen emotionally complex shows like The Sopranos, which centered on brutal mob boss Tony Soprano, a ruthless killer who intimidated everyone around him, but also portrayed him as a deeply troubled man who had recurring panic attacks and who had to battle his own anxiety and self-doubt when he turned to a woman therapist for help.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. So what they didn't know was once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction...
And then there's Good Will Hunting, which catapulted Matt Damon to fame, with Damon playing the role of an intellectually gifted working-class tough guy who relieves the trauma of his abusive childhood by hardening himself to the world and fighting anyone who challenges him. With the support of a woman who loves him and a therapist he comes to trust, finds the courage to battle through his defenses, look inside himself, and let go of his bottled-up rage. After the Newtown Massacre, there was a lot of tough guy talk about how the cure for our violence problem is yet more violence.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
But there were other men who spoke in the wake of Newtown as well. Men like Neil Heslin, whose six-year-old son Jesse was among the 20 children gunned down that tragic day.
He was my son, he was my buddy, he was my best friend.
What was so important about his testimony was that he went beyond expressing grief for his son and directly challenged the culture of violence. Too often we define masculine strength by who can blow away the most people, who can flex the most muscle, who can impose their will and inflict the most damage. But this cheapens the real definition of strength and toughness. We respect the toughness of firefighters who rush into burning buildings when others are rushing out, police officers and other first responders who put their lives on the line, not because they're out to prove something, but because they steel themselves in the face of danger and face down their fears in service to others. For the same reason, we should respect the toughness and strength of men who challenge the myth that being a real man requires putting up a false front, disrespecting others, and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Strength is about adapting to change, not about retreating from it and lashing back with violence out of fear. And it's high time we had a definition of manhood capable of meeting that challenge.
While the program helped to diagnose the root causes of America's increasing levels of hypermasculinity, bullying, and gun violence, as well as the correlation between violence and manhood. But it seems that changing this culture, which is rooted so deeply in grotesque models of violence, is easier said than done. That's it for this week. Do join us next week here on Aperture. Until another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for being with us again on another episode of The Lantern. Alhamdulillah rabbil alameen that we've been given this chance and opportunity. I hope you guys find that the little discussions we have on the show beneficial. I hope that there are some positive takeaways, some positive points, some, you know, little reminders. I'm not saying I'm saying anything new or anything. But sometimes we need reminders, and this is first and foremost a reminder for myself. Aside from the fact that I have the attention span of a miniature teaspoon, I also feel that every time I speak about these things, like every time I go through the process of preparing for them, looking through the ahadith and the ayat, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Oh yeah, I had totally forgotten this. Oh yeah, good point. Oh yeah, I should think about that more. Oh yeah, you know what? I'm gonna write that down. And it's firstly really, you know, useful for me, and I hope you guys, I don't know, thanks for bothering. Anyway, you know, one of the things that children do a lot is comparing. I don't even want to start with parents that compare their children with other children in front of their children. It's really detrimental for the child's mental health and growth. Please don't do that. Just stop right now. It's borderline child abuse. But children also often have a habit of comparing the things that they have with other people. And that's one of the reasons why a great degree of equality and equity is very important for parents to establish among their children, among the siblings. But then on the other hand, it's also important for us to train our kids in a way that they would not constantly look at what their peers have. Like, we come across children that come back from a birthday party and they start pouting and sulking and throwing a fit that, oh, the other kid had a better cake, had a better this, had a better that, and I don't have anything, and they throw their toys around, and like, all of my stuff suck, and I don't want them anymore, and you're the worst parent in the world, and yada, yada, yada. Let's listen to a short story about this, and we're going to be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salam, peace and salutations of Allah the Almighty be upon all of you. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story. It starts like this. A group of highly established alumni got together to visit their old university professor. The conversation among them soon turned into complaints about their stressful work and life. The professor went to his kitchen and returned with a large pot of coffee in an assortment of cups, including porcelain, plastic, glass, crystal, some plain-looking, some expensive, and some exquisite. The professor told them to help themselves to the coffee. After all the students had a cup of coffee in their hands, the professor said, "Did you notice all the nice-looking cups are taken and only the plain, inexpensive ones are left behind? While it is normal for everyone to want the best for themselves, but that is the source of problems and stress in your life. The cup itself adds no quality to the coffee. In most of the cases, it's just more expensive and hides what we drink," the professor continued. "What all of you really wanted was coffee, not the cup. But all of you consciously went for good-looking, expensive cups and then began eyeing on each other's cups. Let's consider that life is the coffee and the jobs, houses, cars, things, money, and position are the cups. The type of the cup we have does not define or change the quality of our lives. Now, what is the moral of this story for today? Sometimes we fail to enjoy the coffee by concentrating only on the cup we have. Being happy doesn't mean everything around you is perfect. It means you've decided to see beyond the imperfections and find peace. And the peace lies within you, not in your career, jobs, or the houses you have."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Once we create balance, that sort of equilibrium in our lives, we will find a lot of, you know, positive manifestations occur, and we will find ourselves in a more comfortable zone of growth. We will not constantly be riddled with anxiety and a sense of doom and failure because we're not doing well enough. We will be reminded that all that matters is that we do our best. I personally think it so does matter in what kind of cup you drink your coffee or tea. But the moral of the story is that at the end of the day, it's just a vessel. It's not going to bring down the worth of what we are consuming. If you put liquid gold is usually pretty darn hot, so you can't really put it in a plastic container. But a really, really valuable perfume, right? Whether you put it in a gold chalice or a plastic cup, it's not going to do anything to the worth of that perfume or that really, really mindlessly expensive liquid. As goes to us, this is really cliche, but all that matters really is what on the inside, what's on the inside. Our body and our car and our home and our clothes and our degree and all of this, they're just vessels. They're just fleeting material things. They're not the objective. They're just means and tools that we utilize during different periods of our lives in order to reach that ultimate objective of our creation. And it's really important for us to be able to focus on these aspects of our lives and create a sense of mindfulness and presence for ourselves so that we can appreciate the things that we have more so that we could be happier with the things that we have, and so that we would not create unnecessary heartache and headache for ourselves by comparing ourselves to those whom backstory we don't really know. We see a snippet, a small glimpse of a person's life, but we see our entire history, our traumas, our wounds, our scars, our talents, our failures, our success, our awkward, cringy moments. We see all of that and we compare it to one moment of hashtag living my best life of another person. And then we neglect or we forget that we have a lot of those moments in our lives too. God knows how many times you've inspired someone, you've made them feel better, they were having a hard day and you acted as a ray of sunlight for them to be able to pick up their own pieces and get back on their feet again. God knows how many times someone found strength and courage from your words, from your random act of kindness, from your good intentions, or from the positive energy you radiate, but you often ignore or dismiss about yourself because you're focusing on your own flaws. Meanwhile, Allah is acknowledging you as His best, most beautiful creation. Don't compare yourself with anyone. The only person you get to compare yourself with, and you should, is the past version of you. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, if 2 days of yours are the same, you failed. What he means is that if you did not achieve something better today, then you didn't gain anything. And sometimes something better today is resting, healing from yesterday. Sometimes it looks like learning from yesterday. Sometimes it really is just doing better today compared to what you did yesterday in any aspect of life. Eternally, externally, spiritually, physically, mentally, you're doing well. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi aman Allah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.